Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cheese lovers and cheese professionals began building our library of cheese books. There are a few staples that we all invest in first, like Mastering Cheese by Max McCallman, The Cheese Primer by Steve Jenkins, and of course, Cheese and Culture, the seminal cheese history book by today's guest, Dr. Paul Kinstead. Hello, listeners. Welcome to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. And welcome, Dr. Kinstead. Thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Awesome. The last time you were here was episode 90, talking about the book I just mentioned, Cheese and Culture, History of Cheese and Its Place in Western Civ. And now here we are at episode 284, having you back again. So I'm sure we have a lot to catch up on. For those of you who aren't familiar with Dr. Kinstead and his work, he's a professor at the University of Vermont, where his primary research relates to the chemistry, crystallography, and structure and function of cheese. He's also the author of another must-read cheese book, American Farmstead Cheese, A Practical Guide to Making and Selling Artisan Cheeses, in which there's a chapter about cheese history that was essentially expanded to turn into Cheese and Culture. So my first question for you is one that I'm sure many of our listeners are asking themselves right now, and that is, what is crystallography as it relates to cheese, and why is that a primary area of your research?
Yeah, great question. Crystals form in, you know, a number of different families of cheese just naturally. They occur over time, particularly in ripened cheeses, and usually the longer a cheese ripens, the more vulnerable it is or susceptible to crystallization. And you know, so what's the relevance of crystals in cheese? Well, both in terms of the visual properties of the cheese. You can see these things if they get big enough, and they can be really misinterpreted in some cases. And that my early research on crystals was looking at them as really a defect on the surface of cheeses back when I was working with large industrial cheesemakers.
Yep.
And they didn't want to have these fluffy white crystals on the surface of cheddar cheese in particular, because it would be mistaken for mold growth or some kind of spoilage by the public. And so I spent a lot of time in the 2000s studying ways to prevent crystallization. But more recently, we've turned the tables and really looked at crystals as a positive attribute, because they also, in many cheeses, are really part of the signature of the cheese in terms of texture and sort of crunchiness and grating properties and so forth. And they also are really a beautiful feature if you know what they are and don't, you know, aren't intimidated by, you know, misconceptions that they may be spoilage. They're natural sort of badges of honor, I would call them, in terms of, you know, a long-aged cheese that has really gone through that long ripening process. Positive things. And then the other thing about crystals that we're really just beginning to appreciate is, in some cheeses, the formation of crystals have collateral effects, you know, profound effects on texture properties that are above and beyond, you know, the impact that the crystals have on your tongue. Particularly in the white mold, bloomy rind type cheeses, washed rind cheeses, that softening process, which is so essential to the character of the cheese, from the surface inwards, that's being driven by crystallization at the surface. And we're really beginning to understand how important crystals are in governing and controlling that process. So for all these reasons, it's a fun thing to study.
I agree. Like as a cheesemonger, say back in the day, maybe like in the mid-90s, you know, I was asking about crystals in cheese, you know, because I would have Dutch cheese like Gouda, you know, yeah. and I would have Gruyere that had little crunchy bits, and people, you know, I never as a cheesemonger never looked at it as a defect. And then customers always came to me and they were like, do you have what are these little crunchy bits that I love? And in my own way, and how it was explained to me back then, is I was like, well, these salts or the amino acids are like grouping together and then trying to push their way out or as they band together. But it's probably a terrible way to explain it. Now I have
That's not bad. It's actually pretty close.
That's good. That's good. I feel better about that. So how did you come to specialize in this area?
Well, because at one point in the early 2000s, it was a very fundable area.
Yeah.
Because the industrial cheesemakers were trying to eradicate these crystals on cheddar. And so it was easy, relatively speaking, to get research funds and to have a research program. And that really got me interested in crystals. But then it was really in 2012, after the money and the funding for eradicating calcium lactate crystals on cheddar had kind of dried up. And there wasn't really very much opportunity to continue that line of research. I happened to be at I was giving a keynote address in Sicily at a conference of the Worldwide Traditional Cheeses Association. This is the first meeting of this new association that was put together to really focus on traditional cheeses worldwide and the needs, the research needs, and the education needs of those traditional cheesemakers. And at that meeting, there were folks from all over the world, great cheesemakers and cheese scientists, and I was talking about my crystal research and was getting all this feedback, like you just gave me a moment ago, that, oh, they love crystals.
Yeah.
They want to use some of these methodologies to study crystals in a positive light. And I woke up in the middle of the night because I had been struggling at this point in 2011, 2012. How am I going to continue to fund my research program?
Certainly.
And I woke up and just, it was like an epiphany, like Archimedes in the bathtub.
Yeah,
Eureka!
That's great.
I can study crystals from a pot. There's a whole series of questions that remain to be answered out there if you look at crystals in the right light, and that really became the catalyst to develop a program to look at crystals positively.
What kind of discoveries have you in crystallography have been made since you were last here in 2012 and around that time? Like, what's the positive effect? How did you turn that around?
Yeah, well, one of the things we're finding out there are players in different families of cheese, crystal types that we didn't even realize were there and that are important. For example, in Grana Italian cheeses, Parmigiano Reggiano,
yeah,
Grana Padano types, and various cheeses in that style.
Yeah,
there are significant elements there that we call pearls or these spherical structures that have leucine crystals as part of the structure, and these things are prominent, very prevalent in these Grana cheeses, also in really long age Gouda cheeses,
yeah,
Gouda and Edam, we had no idea that leucine crystallization was part of the makeup of these elements, which are very important for the textural properties, the rating properties, the granularity of these types of cheeses.
And they seem like they would also be like those ones I always identified. They look like snowflakes, you know. They're really visible as opposed to the little sort of pinprick ones that I see in Gruyere. And I always wondered. I always thought that was because of the way that the curds were worked in the cheese making process. But it's probably more in terms of its way. It's the way the cheese is, the milk is cultured in the very beginning process, and the way the curds are cut. Is that somewhere somewhere that along
seems,
there?
Yeah, that seems to be, you know, as we study these things and try and understand where they come from, what the causative factors are. But, you know, the little hard ones are typically tyrosine,
right,
which are amino acids, as you've explained, where they crystallize into these very large, hard entities that you can feel, and they're crunchy. The pearls and some of the fluffy crystal entities are often lysine, which are coming from particular cultures, we believe, that form this amino acid preferentially. Leucine, not lysine. Leucine is an amino acid like tyrosine. And if it accumulates to high enough concentrations due to the proteolysis that's mm-hmm. being driven by the cultures and the microflora and the microbiota, then leucine will crystallize very differently from tyrosine, and you get this other type of entity forming. And the openness of the texture seems to play a role. There's been some excellent work done in Italy just recently by good friends and colleagues there that have identified that as little micro openings in the structure as very important for the formation of these entities.
I work from the perspective of a cheesemonger, you know? So I'm always trying to deconstruct and be economical with my time, you know?
Yep.
So what something would be really helpful in a question that I think would for the cheesemongers that are out and listening to us is, so if a person comes up to us at the counter and they say, what are these crystals? I could always refer them to this podcast, which I would like to do, but what's the most economical way for a cheesemonger to explain that to a customer or to a fellow cheesemonger?
Yeah, that's a great question. We ought to put together a catalog of,
right,
of images of crystals, you know, at the visible state where you can see them, and a descriptive identity of what they are and what we know about where they come from. I've had this thought ever since 2012 in the middle of the night when I woke up having my epiphany at major cheesemongers, cheese shops, you know, big blown up photographs of different crystals. They're really beautiful to look at, actually.
Yeah, they're incredible. I've actually seen some microscopic some images of them. They're really neat.
they're absolutely gorgeous, and they're a selling point, I believe, a positive attribute.
Well, they 100% are. I mean, I have never once. I wonder in terms of that, why were they looked upon as a defect simply because the industrial makers were trying to make something with a uniform texture that consumers could you know, not mistake for something that was wrong? Is that what it was?
Correct. That in industrial cheesemaking, uniformity is everything.
Yeah.
And anything that upsets the apple cart, that looks different or tastes different or feels different in the palate is threatening. Uniformity is everything. So when you have these fluffy crystals or this kind of a film, a smear of white haze on the surface of the cheese, the customer for that type of cheese is not accustomed to differences, and they, you know, the default assumption is, there's something wrong with this. It must be mold or something else. The other thing, and this is an issue, sometimes crystals can be, you know, very positive attribute when they're present at the right level, right size. But if they get too big, even in long-aged, you know, raw milk cheddar, you can have internally calcium lactate crystals that become very, very large, and they're very hard. And even, you know, sort of discriminating customers can mistake them for a foreign object or
totally
intimidated by these things.
Well, the thing is, you know, you want a certain uniformity in the texture of cheese always, both as a consumer and a cheesemonger, because when you have something, those crystals, they take up room, and when you're breaking down a cheese, if they are large like that, if you have like an old Gouda or like a really old Parmigiano, they break you aren't able to break the cheese down completely properly, you know, and they get a little sort of oily or like pussy around the edge, and that's not good, right?
It does change. That's right. It does change, you know, various attributes of the cheese in ways that, you know, you go too far. In terms, too much of a good thing is not a good thing.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's an interesting clock, you know what I mean? Cheese, to me, is such a great timekeeper, you know? It's amazing. It's just this wonderful, like, hourglass, frozen hourglass, you know, that, but still stuff is going on. So, I mean, it's, I understand a little bit, you know. I always mess up the science. I always do, you know.
You're doing great so far.
That's because I was trained not to say anything wrong on this particular episode. No, but that's fantastic. So the answer, I guess, in the short way is to, as a cheesemonger, is to just assure them, I guess, that nothing is wrong, that there are a few types of crystals involved in the cheesemaking process that happen as a result of the cheesemaking process, and for people to enjoy them. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And I think the burden is on, you know, the academic research community to put together, you know, visual and written aids to help cheesemongers, retailers, understand what the crystals are, identify them, and communicate that to their customers. You know, so I would love to put together one of my pet projects before I retire is to put together, you know, some kind of a scorecard. Here's all the crystals that we know about. Here's what they look like. Here's what we know about them. And, you know, show these things to your customers when questions come up or whatever. A little encyclopedia of crystals.
That would be absolutely amazing. I would appreciate that. Until then, I'm just going to stick with my original story, which you have validated, and I really appreciate that.
Yep. No, I think you're in good shape.
Awesome. So we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk a little bit about climate change as it refers to cheesemaking. Hold on.
Great.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sirchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sirchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sirchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
I like it when cheese is described as a love child. That really just makes me happy. Hello and welcome back to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live in the Heritage Radio Network. This is Greg Blazin. On the line, we have Dr. Paul Kinstedt, author and professor at the University of Vermont. Before the break, we were talking about cheese crystallography, which is super interesting and an area of research for Dr. Kinstedt. In the second half, I wanted to talk to you more about your research in cheese history and how that's been influenced by your science-based scholarship that we were talking about a tiny bit before the break. Can you tell us a little bit about how these two different ideas of research come together for you?
Yeah, it's been amazing in the last 5 years or so, and it goes back to this meeting I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, in Sicily. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that.
Where I was you know, speaking at on my research and on cheese and culture, basically. And one of the other keynote speakers at the meeting was a person by the name of Setsuchi Sirod.
Yeah, Mongolian gentleman. Yeah,
she is a Mongolian cheese.
I am so sorry, Mongolian lady. I'm sorry.
And
I'm the worst.
She's also a member of the National Dairy Program for Mongolia. She's a government official and member of the International Dairy Federation, and she had just come off an assignment dealing with a humanitarian crisis aid relief in Mongolia. Because of what was happening to the nomadic cheesemakers, the nomads in Mongolia, who were in crisis and still are in crisis because of climate fluctuation and environmental deterioration, And she gave a very impassioned talk about you know what's happening in Mongolia, this absolute crisis in this long-standing traditional nomadic cheesemaking culture that is about to disappear because of you know these catastrophic changes in climate, in the environment, and she sort of you know gave a plea to the world to sit up and listen about climate change and look at what's happening in Mongolia. And I had a chance to talk with her after the meeting a couple times, and we just chatted. And I was astonished at you know this story that I had not heard about, and this crisis going on. And I said to Setshi that when I got back to the United States, I will do what I can. I promise you, to try and spread the word to my country, to raise the level of awareness about what's going on. And so I returned to the U.S. in February of 2012, and had a lot of interviews because Cheese and Culture was just about to be released, and I was sort of on the speaking trail. And I tried to slip this in, you know, what's going on in Mongolia in television, radio interviews, and it never went anywhere. That you know, there wasn't a lot of reaction, and I was disappointed. So anyways, you know, time goes on, and I start my cheese crystal research program, and we get to 2015, last summer, and I'm eligible for another sabbatical leave, and so much has happened in the cheese history area that could add to Cheese and Culture, and there was so much that was left undone in the first edition of Cheese and Culture that I decided to write a sabbatical application to prepare a second edition of Cheese and Culture. And as part of that second edition, I endeavored to make climate change and how it's affected cheesemaking during the last 10,000 years and cheesemakers in profound ways over and over again. Climate change, climate fluctuation, how profound it's been, and then to use Mongolia and what's been happening there in the last 100 years and tracking back for the last 10,000 years as a case study for us to look at how absolutely monumental climate change has been in our past as a human species and the precipice that we're standing on right now in terms of the uncertainty of the future. Wake up, folks.
Yeah, no kidding.
And the hope is that cheese is engaging enough that you will get an audience to listen to this a little bit more. Now, I know there's a lot of interest out there in climate change, but there's still, as you know, all this pushback.
It's very crazy. I don't understand it. I mean, some of it is natural because the sun expands, you know what I mean? The stars expand. And
it's been happening, you know, but regardless of whether it's human-induced or natural, and it's been happening, you know, all of the Earth's history.
Sure.
And in the last 10,000 years that human, you know, human civilizations have really been developing, the effects have been absolutely profound and catastrophic.
Yeah.
And if human activity is going to add to the uncertainty of the natural fluxes that occur, we have to take that seriously. That's my position.
And well, I agree with it. And the thing is, when you talk about cheese and cheese made in Mongolia, you have 10, you know, you said you have 10,000 years, right? Is that what you're saying? Like,
I mean, what I'm doing is tracking back.
Way back.
How did cheese making start there? And you really have to track back all the way to the very beginning of cheese making in Southwest Asia, the Near East. Fertile Crescent, and there is a thread that is continuing. It is amazing.
Yeah.
One of the big questions when we started Cheese and Culture and the concept is, did cheese making originate in one place and then spread everywhere else?
Right.
Or did it originate independently in lots of different places, and so there's lots of different origins? And one of the big questions that I wasn't able to address in the first edition was the whole Eurasian steppes, you know, into Mongolia, and that whole herding, you know, traditional nomadic cheesemaking there and up into Tibet. And where did that come from? And I think now we've got some answers in terms of the flow of history. And now that's about to disappear after, you know, 5,000 years.
That's insane. And you can use the Mongols. I mean, I listen to a lot of history of the Khans. I listen to this great history podcast called Hardcore History by this guy, Dan Carlin. And I was, you know, was just trolling back through all of this Mongolian history. You know, this general Subadai took this expeditionary force, you know, into the over the Urals and that went into Russia and just caused fucking havoc there. You know what I mean? But they brought everything with them, you know, so it would make sense that they would bring those those traditions along with them on their warpath. You know what I mean? Or their, you know, on the expeditionary journey that they were on, you know, and that made sense to me because I always was, you know, a big, you know, teller of the story. Again, as a cheesemonger, you know, people are like, so who made the first cheese? You know, and I'm like, great question. And I always say, you know, what I learned was, you know, there was a traveler in the Gobi Desert with a skin of goat's milk, that whole story, you know, the milk curdle. But I've always wondered that myself in terms of the actual origins. But looking through that history, especially the history of Mongolia, seems like the perfect way to do it. Like, so you have so much time that you can look at the effects of the changing earth. These people, just to bring us back to your topic with, I mean, your discussion with her, is it feed? Is it the process? Is it the availability of them to culture their own milk? Is it a combination of all of those things? Is that why it's going away?
Well, it's you know, it's really two things that have really happened in the last 100 years, the 20th century, 21st century, and it's a long story, but to put it in a nutshell,
we got time.
You know, catastrophic socioeconomic spiritual upheaval in Mongolia since 1921. The way of life that organized nomadic herding and kept it sustainable for all those millennia disappeared with the communist revolution,
right,
and the collectivization of the herding structure of the country, basically 1959, you know, the Soviet model, where the traditional herding was changed from the family structure
cooperative farms there, yeah,
or that were designed to scale up the process and make it much more professionalized, if you will, and that worked, and there was some good things that happened during that period. It kept kept the landscape relatively sustained in terms of, you know, the Mongolian steppes are very, very fragile. They can be easily overgrazed.
Sure.
Any flux in rainfall can be enormously influential in terms of the productivity of these steppes. So in 1993, when communism collapsed and the whole system was decollectivized, there was a massive movement of people out of the cities, particularly the capital city in Mongolia, back to the land. So between 1990 and 1999, as people left the cities to return to their traditional herding and nomadic lifestyle, the number of animals on the Mongolian steppes went from something like 26 million to 33 million.
Wow.
That's an enormous increase.
You need a lot more food for that.
Grazing.
Yeah, you need a lot more food.
and a lot of this was goats. And the reason was because we've gone now to a market economy, and the market for Kashmir was very, very lucrative.
Yeah,
and
still
and
is.
Goats are really environmentally destructive.
Yeah,
if they overgraze. By 2008, we now have 44 million animals.
Oh,
and so the bottom line is because of this you know, sort of market response, this change in culture, and the other thing is that the traditional spiritual religious traditional system that kept Mongolian herders in line in terms of avoiding environmentally destructive practices. There were a lot of taboos in the traditional spiritual system that protected the environment. All that knowledge was forgotten during and exterminated during the communist era.
Brutal.
And so now we have all, you know, this increase in number of animals and herding families, and they don't have the traditional infrastructure, the practices. And so we have a situation where 2008 study, 70% of the steppes in Mongolia are classified as degraded, 31% severely degraded.
Jesus Christ.
And just because of overgrazing and you know, practices that are unsustainable. And then on top of that, we've had climactic upheaval, not
sure.
just socioeconomic, but this as the global temperatures have shifted, Mongolia has increased over the last 80 years four times faster or higher in average temperature than the planet, because it's in this microenvironment that is very susceptible to climate shifts. So it's been a catastrophic shift in climate, and the repercussions have been threefold. Number one, are more frequent and intense occurrences of these what's called ZUDs, or winter disasters.
Yeah.
Severe cold, snow and ice that cause, you know, millions and millions of animals to die. They can't survive the winter. On top of that, shifting rainfall patterns causing extended droughts. Last 60 years, and particularly last 20 years, we've seen increases in the, you know, the droughts as well as the severe winters. And then overall permafrost thawing up in the north of Mongolia, where it's permafrost like in Siberia, and that's wreaking havoc on the forest steppes up to the north. So all this is happening when you have more animals than ever overgrazing.
Well, the balance is all off. The balance is off.
Is deeply off.
And you had a way of life that protected the steppes and made cheese in a certain way that disrupted. The Soviet Union comes in, changes all of that. A lot of the old knowledge is lost, but the animals keep reproducing, you know, and the people keep reproducing, but the earth has been neglected, and then the earth changes on its own, and then we accelerate that change, and everything just gets messed up royally. That's how it seems to me, you know.
You just framed it beautifully, and I'm going to argue in Cheese and Culture that this is a microcosm. It's not just Mongolia.
No.
There are wide swaths of Africa that are you know, pastoral nomads in the same boat, that we could have absolute catastrophe, a little shift in weather patterns in these fragile environments. And if you think the migration out of Africa into, you know, across the Mediterranean to Sicily and Italy right now is, you know, we have these tragic situations of people.
Yeah, they're being displaced. They're going everywhere.
They're going everywhere. They're desperate. They're dying in the Mediterranean because their creaky boats tip over. This is just the tip of the iceberg, I believe. Potentially, if there are, you know, continued changes in climate, we could be in for some. I mean, absolutely catastrophic situation. Mongolia is kind of the canary in the mine because it's so
sure.
But it's not the only place.
Well, no, in Mongolia, you have a very markedly non-industrial way to produce cheese and a very non-industrial revolution way of life, you know. So you're going to see the effects of the earth. Here we're insulated, you know. We're all in boxes or condominiums and our, you know what I mean, or whatever, however and however we live. So we can outlast a little bit longer, you know what I mean, just because we've sort of insulated ourselves against Mother Earth a little bit here. But, I mean, what do you see? When do you see, or how do you see, the effects of climate change affecting Europe cheese making or United States cheese making? Is it the same thing, just the same idea, just a different group of people? Is it just it's just the same thing?
Well, I mean, everywhere, you know, particularly for Europe, you know, the further south, the Mediterranean basin, which is you know, largely marginal land. It's not very good agricultural land. That's why. Goats and sheep have always predominated in
yeah, they're not as picky eaters, right? I mean, they'll eat different stuff, basically, right?
Yeah. Cows need a lot of water.
Yes.
They need very lush vegetation. So, but goats and sheep are you know, much more capable of living on marginal land. But that makes that whole Mediterranean basin very vulnerable because it's marginal land to begin with, and if there's extended weather pattern shifts and extended droughts, you know, it could, you know, cheesemakers there could very well, and particularly the Middle East and down into Africans and Northern Africa, that whole Mediterranean region is very vulnerable. But even, you know, even the more well-watered, you know, Central Europe and Northwest Europe and so forth, any changes in climate have an impact. They affect, you know, the ability to raise forages and pasture quality and on and on and on. So, you know, nobody is insulated. The United States, we've got, you know, massive forest fires right now because of drought in our east, you know, southeast. You know what's been happening out in the west with drought.
But it's happening in the northeast too. I mean, my family's up there too. The reservoirs are all shrinking. They didn't get enough.
Our farmers up here are hurting.
Yeah.
We are dry.
I know.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing about climate change and global warming. It's not, you know, the 1 or 2 degree temperature difference. It seems like, big deal. I don't mind if my winters are a little bit warmer. It's the shift in weather patterns and rainfall, because it is this complex, you know, energy system that redistributes the solar energy coming in from the sun across the planet through the oceans and the weather patterns and the precipitation patterns, and you mess with that system,
you're in trouble.
The whole world is influenced. Right now, the Arctic, you know, circle is undergoing, as I understand it, a strange warming, and this whole you know, intensely cold region, which should be up in the North Pole now, is slipping down into Siberia.
Yeah.
And my fear is that is going to, I don't know this, but I just read this the other day, but I'm wondering if Mongolia is in for another catastrophically cold winter, if that you know, weather pattern shifts down. The thing that is critical is to understand what causes these weather pattern shifts, and that's where the cheese crystals.
Yeah.
The fact that some of the crystals that we find growing on these cheeses, calcium carbonate variants, are the same minerals that are in geological deposits that archaeoclimatologists use to help reconstruct ancient Earth climate.
That's great.
And it could very well be, it could possibly be, that as we study the formation of these crystals on the surface of our cheeses and understand the mechanisms by which that happens, that may potentially help to inform the archaeoclimatology area, you know, so that they can better understand ancient crystallization phenomena that they're using to reconstruct climate history.
Is cheese not the most amazing thing? Like how it's just such a barometer. I always describe it as the earth working hard to preserve itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
through the milk. It's incredible.
It's a living thing, organism that can tell us, you know, many, you know, about our world and about who we are in ways that we never imagined if we don't look and open the door. Lift up a few rocks to see what's under there.
Yeah, I love lifting up rocks. I like to see what's under there. That's why I love the cheese. It's a big rock, and I keep lifting it up all the time.
You bet.
Well, thank you. You know, and I really want to thank you for coming on today. It was a pleasure. You know, it's been a long gap in between episodes for you, but we're going to get you back on really soon. And, you know, take a look out there at the earth and know that the cheese is a representative of the earth, one of the best ones out there. So,
I agree.
Thanks, Dr. Kinstead. I really appreciate it. We'll be talking to you soon. And thank you all for listening. Tune in next week for more Cutting the Curd. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.